Okay, everyone. It is March 8th, 2021. As always, lots of interesting things. I want to begin with something which is relevant to what we do in this class, I think. I wasn't the subject or the object, I should say, of the criticism, but I think it's something I thought about, and it's been getting a lot of talk. A number of you must have seen it. There's this online journal called Tablet, which I highly recommend everyone who's interested in intellectual things, not just Jewish things, intellectual, public intellectual type of things, subscribe to. And you get in your inbox a couple times a week. One that just came today, and Robert alerted me to it, and I saw it also, was about they do a lot about Haredim. And Haredi women singers who are all over YouTube with hundreds of thousands of hits. At least they call themselves Haredi, but it's if they want to call themselves, let them call themselves. But Haredi women singers. But this is from a guy, Cole Aronson, who I don't know. He describes himself as coming from a non-Orthodox background, who then became Orthodox. He's now learning in Har Tzion, Gush. So obviously he's an intellectual. But he writes about how, for the sake of Jewry, the Orthodox should give up their private dialect. And he doesn't mention Torah in Motion, but he mentions YU Torah. He says, if you listen to Shiurim, it's like inside baseball. All this, like on the right here, although we would never use language like this, but yeshivish in English. He's a great friend of Klal Yisrael and his mechotanim are from. Translation, he's a great friend of the Jews and his in-laws are observant. So he's writing about how he felt he didn't understand any of this language and he feels it does a great disservice. All I would say to that is if you listen, obviously, I mean, he wants people to say Abraham and Moses, not Avraham and Moshe. If you listen to us, we're not speaking, we don't say he's eating by. We're not using this sort of yeshivish language, but we use, first of all, we use terms, halachic terms. This is a group of people with a certain knowledge. And also, I think, you know, we say he gave tzedakah. We don't say charity usually. We daven. We don't pray. If you ever speak to the Syrians, they say we're going to pray. It sounds very weird because from us, it sounds like a non-religious thing to go pray. But so he has a whole thing. It's I find it interesting. But at the end of the day, every culture has inside talk. If you're in the Black community, the Hispanic community, I work at a Catholic university. I don't see it negative like he does. In fact, he says something right at the beginning where I've been in yeshivish circles a long time. I just think he's wrong. He's saying, for example, he gives examples like David, what does Alachas Kama Vakama mean? Or what is the triangle K? And why would anyone why wouldn't someone, what that guy say, hold by it? But then he says another example of yeshivish. Can't just anyone bavorn? I have no clue what bavorn means. If anyone knows, I sort of think he's wrong and it's he's confused. That as far as I know, there's no such thing as bavorn. But it's a very interesting article, and he says that when he first started hearing this, I was the lonely man of faithfulness. Obviously, a play on the lonely man of faith. So I highly recommend this article, and I'm sure we're going to hear more in the future from Cole Aronson. The next
Doctor,
thing...
Dr. Yeah. Mark, if I can interrupt for a second, you know, I don't even know if I ever sent it to you because you've been with us for so long. When we have, you know, all our speakers, I send them like a little kind of, you know, instruction guide, what to do, speakers. And one of the things I always say, they don't always listen, is that every Hebrew term should be translated into English. Because even though we want high-level classes, nuanced, sophisticated, there are people whose background is not so good. So when you use these terms, even I agree, not Abraham and Moses, but other terms. So it's very interesting. It's after, you know, my mother used to yell at me if I say he learns out. She couldn't stand that expression, you know, somebody learns out and all the yeshivish, you know, improper English.
But anyway, it's tough for us because we're doing with halachic concepts. Right. But yeah, we try.
For sure. You have to find the happy medium. I agree.
And he does quote, and someone points out, I see in the notes, he had something in the Jewish Review of Books, and he actually called his sites, believe it or not, there was a book that came out on FrumSpeak, and it was reviewed in the Jewish Review of Books by my favorite, John McWhorter, and Cole mentions that. So I look forward to more from him. I listened to the tape about making of a Godot. I want to make one more point, which I didn't, in terms of the Chayrim, the ban. and I had a correspondence with someone, and I mentioned, you know, someone made a joke, or maybe it wasn't a joke. Do I want my books to be banned? At the end of the day, there's a sociological element here. Books are only banned if you're in the community. No one's going to ban Natan Slifkin's books now. He's not in the community. If you're going to ban books that don't go with the Haredi Hashkafa, you'd be banning books every day. It's only books in the community and people who are thought to be problematic because they're in the community. So, for instance, I thought of this because I was reading Dolphin's new book. Here it is. Published three books this year, Chabad and Gedolim Part 2. Now, let me just read you what he says. He's talking about Rav Ruderman's relationship with Chabad, but he just speaks about other things, about Rav Ruderman and Rav Huttner. And he writes as follows, where this is the sort of thing that Nussan Kamenetsky wrote, and that's why they banned it. And this comes from a student. I was going to say a Talmud, but thanks to Cole, I'll say a student of Rabbi Ruderman. And he says as follows, once while arranging, this comes from Rabbi Janowski of Miami. Once while arranging his library, Rabbi Ruderman related that Rabbi Huttner asked him what he thought of his approach, referring to him demanding respect, kavod haTorah, and practicing an elitist form of gadlus haAdam, when you stress the greatness of man. Rabbi Ruderman replied, he quotes the Yiddish, du foyos sich lernen gemara, rashi and tosfos, hastu gemach anayim derech. You are lazy, too lazy to study the Talmud with the commentators, so you made a new approach. That's the sort of thing that you find there in Russell Kamenetsky. This is so much what we spoke about, that the rabbis, just like the rabbis of the Talmud, speak to each other, and we're not supposed to maybe, you know, be led into the criticisms. Obviously, Rabbi Ruderman or Rav Huttner, could mock Rav Huttner a little and say, jokingly, because I do think he was saying it jokingly, you're too lazy to really look into the Gemara, so you come up with all this other mishigas. That's what he's thinking. But to see it in print, it's a little bit jarring. What he's referring to, incidentally, about Rav Huttner is Rav Huttner did believe in Kavod HaTorah, and he insisted on... He demanded respect. And I'm told his daughter, who has the seminary, does the same thing. I'll give you an example, a story of this. The story with the legendary Rabbi Yerucham Gorelick. He was looking for a school to send his son. And he couldn't send him to high school. He couldn't send him to MTA, if you know Rabbi Gorelick. So he went to visit Chaim Berlin. And when he went in to meet Rav Huttner, he was told by the assistant, when he leaves the meeting with Rav Huttner, he should walk out stepping backwards, not turn his back to him. And Rabbi Gorelick's attitude was, what kind of crazy place is this? Let's go. We got to go find some other yeshiva. But it's a method of God, of instilling respect. One of the people heard on YouTube emailed me. I quoted Rabbi Ben Amozik and Susanna made a comment, which I responded, that certain things in the Torah incorporate activities that were in the general population. And someone wanted to know, well, is this held by other rabbanim? Is this a radical thing? At first, I don't think it's radical at all. Even from an academics perspective, we find many examples, as Bar Yechler's articles, others. But the Rambam himself mentions this about sacrifices. But leaving that aside, I want to show you a book. It's called Perush HaTorah L'Rabbeinu Avraham Ben Arambam. Two volumes came out last year and this year, and also one volume of the Rav Avraham Ben Arambam's Introduction to Agadah. It's edited by a man named Moshe Maimon, who happens to be the grandson of Rav Solomon Maimon of Seattle. He is an incredible person. He's a friend of mine, but he's incredible. He's a Lakewood guy, learned in Brisk, but then he taught himself Arabic. And what you have here is a new translation of the two volumes. Look how thick it is. This is volume on Shmos. We only have on Bereishis and Shmos. Two volumes full with notes. I mean, he lives in Muncie. He lives in Lakewood, teaches in Muncie. But this is full of notes, academic notes, Torah notes. What a combination. He should win an award for these two volumes. These are the things that you'll be reading in 100 years. It's such an important contribution to scholarship. And actually, it's a beautiful volume, too. I don't know if you could see. It has a picture on the front here. It's beautiful, of Rav Avraham Ben Arambam's signature. The publisher is the same one who put out the Sefer we're studying together. And if you look in volume 2 of Abreshis, volume 1, page 354, Rav Avraham Ben Arambam mentions how Yibum, levirate marriage, is something that came before the Torah. And then it says, Af al fi shehi mi mitzvah la Torah, haya minhag mi mei kedem, vihishiro to ha Torah, uchaze b'ksat shara mitzvah b'li safek. Rav Avraham and Rambam says this, that the Torah incorporated things that came from before Matan Torah. So you, and as is his method, Kedarko HaKodesh, I should say, Rabbi Maimon has a long, long note giving all sorts of examples of it. The book actually appears with approbations from both Rabbi Shelat and Rabbi Mazuz, in addition to other people. I have two more things I want to share with you. Actually, one more thing. And this goes back to the, at the end of class, Mel asked a good question. If we recall, I had said that I spoke about how there's a dispute in the Talmud, in Masachat Sukkah. Why do we dwell in the Sukkah? Is it because we dwelled in Sukkot, actually literally tabernacles, or the Ananei Kavod, the clouds of glory? And I mentioned it's a dispute in the Talmud. And the Shulchan Aruch, when the Shulchan Aruch gives his ruling, the Shulchan Aruch adopts in the Shulchan Aruch that it's because of the Ananei HaKavod. And I asked, and Rabbi Mazuz mentions that Shulchan Aruch Paskins. So I wrote to him, what do you mean Shulchan Aruch Paskins? Why is this at all relevant? He offers an explanation, but it's not Psak. And Rabbi Mazuz said, well, technically you're right, it's not Psak. However, we need to know it because you have a Kavana when you sit in the sukkah. And I said, well, I just threw out there, like, I guess this is for Kabbalistic reasons. And Mel in the comments said, no, not just for Kabbalistic reasons. And then I replied, but I think that's what the Kaf HaChaim mentioned. So I looked at the Kaf HaChaim, and the Kaf HaChaim does speak about Kabbalistic Goshen Yichud, but the Kaf HaChaim does not mention, but the Kaf HaChaim, this is in Tafrei Shleafei, He's quite apart from that, he says you have to have kavana, thinking about why you're in the sukkah, that it's ananei hakavod. And I was thinking about this during the week because it didn't really make sense to me. Why? When why every other mitzvah do I do? We have tamei mitzvot, reasons for the commandments, but we don't think about them. Lishma means you do the mitzvah for the sake of the mitzvah. That's what Reb Chaim Volozhin taught us. So where else do you have this notion that when you do the mitzvah, like we observe Shabbos, we observe it because this reason, or we do it, we mention it, but that's the mitzvah is not totally, as we say, not dependent on it. All the other things we do, it's kavana means not the kavana of the reason. The kavana is the intention to do it. Well, while I was pondering this and not coming up with any good answers, Rabbi Mordechai, well, I think at the end, when we finish and I don't know, 7-8 classes, we should have like all the pictures of all these people. We got Rabbi Mordechai, we have Rabbi Elay, we have Reuven from Paris, we have a whole group of Robert. You know them all, but by first name. So maybe we'll show their pictures if they're willing. Rabbi Mordechai pointed out something amazing, which I want to share with you, which I did not know. And it's in the Bach, the Bais Chadash of Rav Yoel Sirkis. If you look in Hilchos Sukkah, Tafresh Chet Hey, that's where the Shulchan Aruch gets it, where the Torah says, you focus on the Anani HaKavod. And the Bach says as follows, why does the Torah tell us this? Again, he has the question I had. And the Bach says that sukkah is an exception. Sukkah, you need to focus, according to the Torah, on the reason. Why? Why does he say this? Because the pasuk says, "Laman yedu dor sechem," so that everyone will know. And therefore, everyone know what? The kavana of the mitzvah. And then he says, there's two other examples, the Bach says, and which he quotes from the Torah. The Torah gives the reason. The Torah tells us in Hochos Tzitzis, in Siman Ches, the Torah tells us that he says you should have kavana when you wear it, that God told us to wear it, that we should remember all the mitzvos. And also in Hochos Tefillin, the Torah says, I don't recall if the Shulchan Aruch mentions this as well, but the Torah says as well, he gives the reason what, when you wear it, what you're supposed to have, what the kavana is supposed to be. So the Bach explains, and why? Why does the Bach explain? Why are these separate, tzitzis and tefillin? Because again, look at tzitzis. The Bach tells us, he says he doesn't do it with any other mitzvos, where you have to have a separate kavana. just have the mitzvah and do that, because it says by tzitzis, lamantiz karu. We all know lamantiz karu, as we say it. You should remember it. That implies not just to do it, but to have another intention. What does it say, tefillin? Lamanti atar Hashem b'ficha. So the Torah actually says, the Bach actually says that the sukkah, tefillin, and tzitzis are exceptions, in that the tam, the understanding of the commandment, is tied in to the mitzvah, like we don't have with other mitzvot. Incidentally, one more point, which in the new Machon Yerushalayim edition, it points out, interestingly, it's a bit of a problem why Rabbi Eliezer says that it's Ananei HaKavod, and Rabbi Akiva says it's actual Sukkot. Because if you look in the Halachic Midrash, the names are reversed, and it seems that other people have the names reversed, perhaps even in the Talmud. So it's, and because normally we would assume we'd go with Rabbi Akiva. So anyone who's interested in exploring it more, you can look that up. Oh, I do see one more thing I want to point out to you. This ties right into what we're going to do now, because we stopped, if you recall, in the middle of the letter back and forth to Rabbi Mazuz about the issue of the refrigerator on Shabbos and Sikreshet Onichale, which I'll do some clarification on in a second. And I'll show you, we didn't get to his reply yet. But before I do that, I just want to share something, because my impressions have been over the years that there's a lot has happened recently when it comes to electricity, and people are unaware of it. So I want to share a few things that maybe you don't know. The first is, a couple of years ago, the following came out. The Shabbos switch. Here it is. Something called the kosher switch. This came out with the approbations of some really leading rabbis. You can go to the website and see all about it. This guy worked a number of years on it, put a lot of money in, and it would enable you, you can still buy it, but because the great rabbis didn't go along with it, no one's going to, it would enable you to turn lights on Shabbos. The way it works is that, like, let's say if you opened your door, and then maybe sometime during the day, a wind would come in and turn on the light. So that would be fine, because there's no grumble, you're not setting anything up. The technology here is that every second, like thousands of things are going back and forth. And it's the same thing, by you opening it up, there's no guarantee that it'll turn on the light. But since millions of things are happening in a second, the light usually will go on within a second or two. And so this seemed to be a way where you could turn on the light on Shabbos. And although the ruling of the big rabbis was that it's a grumma and they wouldn't allow it, you can look on the website here. You can see a lot of big rabbis who supported it. They all then had to retract. You can even see lectures on it, videos. Here, let me show you what... this is a well-known posek in America, in New York, before he was forced to retract or was convinced. Listen to what he says. This would have changed the way we live.
I've seen the kosher switch, which is produced by Reb Menashe Kalati. I've read the Kuntres. And all the details which is mentioned in the Kuntres, and as far as the switch has been demonstrated, it is clear this is not a groma. It's Atil Cheshabbos. There is no question of any malacha being done by using that switch. Mitzad Hasheni, I recommend that anyone ask their own Rav to find out whether it is within the spirit of Shabbos, although there is no real malacha, but ask your Rav regarding the actual practical usage.
In fact, my 10th grade Rebbe was even interviewed, I guess, because he lives by him, and listen to what he says. And then on the website, there's a retraction that, here, my 10th grade Rebbe.
After having observed the way in which it works, it's dynamic, it seems, in my humble opinion, that al pi halacha is completely permissible.
And then he goes on. So that didn't take off. However, there is something else. If you don't know about, and you can read about it on Wikipedia, all about the kosher switch. There's another item that is permissible. It even comes with an OU on it. you're wondering, the OU, they don't only give hashkacha, they give hashkacha to at least a couple of matters. Not everyone knows about it, but there is a way to have lamps on Shabbos. I travel with a special light that I use. I can turn it on and off on Shabbos. I bring it to the hotel. I bring it to Europe. In the Morocco trip, I was talking about it, and no one believed me, but someone on the bus actually had it with them. So I want to show you something now, and this is 100% mutter. If you've never seen it, it will change your life. You could have a nightlight on Shabbos. You could have other things. It's called the Shabulb. Well, here's the video of it. Is it? No, that's Rabbi Olbaum. You can get it at all the Sfarim stores. Here you go. Let's play it.
Two kinds of people on Shabbos. Those who can't read. And despite some creative but dangerous solutions, there are those who can't sleep. Introducing Shabulb, the kosher solution to all Shabbos lighting problems, be it too much or too little light. As you slide the lever, tiny covers slide over the LED lights inside the bulb. Cutting-edge technology meets out-of-the-box thinking in the only bulb you can actually adjust on Shabbos.
Shabulb, your Shabbos lighting solution.
So that is no different than the item that became popular where they called that thing you turned, I forgot what they called it. This is, the light doesn't go off. It just, you close it and open it. And this can plug into any of your, it's just a bulb. It's a regular bulb. So the idea that you can't turn your bulbs on and off, now you can turn bulbs on and off. And this has been accepted by everyone, even the Satmar. Have it, and but I'm surprised when I tell people about it on my trips, and they still have never heard of it. The Shabbat. Ad Khan. Let us now move to the safer. More interesting things, as always. Someone emailed me because I'm always saying interesting things. Have we ever had a class that didn't have interesting things? I hope not, because then what's the point of coming out on a Monday night at 8:30 if it's not going to be interesting? I hope at least Jacob Neusner, who wrote like 10 books a year, and he was always criticized. How can you write so much? He said, if I say even one new thing in a book, it could be a 300-page book, that makes it worth it. I wouldn't go that far, but if we say one or two new things, then it's worth it. We are in the middle of the letter to Rabbi Mazuz. I forgot, incidentally, that in the last letter, right at the end, I sent him something from Rabbi Gorin, which I think you'd appreciate it, because Rabbi Mazuz writes that yeshiva students should go on tiyuim. You shouldn't be so pious and say, well, I'm not going to go on a tiyu. I'm going to stay in learning. My son, by the way, they can go on to Yulim now. So he's in the Golan. And if he told me, I mean, he tells me he goes to sleep early. He's getting up at like 5:30 or 6 a.m. every morning to Chazer, to review and all that. If he said, I'm staying because I want to learn, it would be a mistake. And when Rabbi Mazuz said that, I sent him what appears in Rav Gorin's autobiography. He tells us the following story, that when he was young, he was with Rav Kook. And he was with him. They were Hara Carmel, and he took a Gemara with him, and he was sitting and he was learning. Rav Gorin used to do 10 blot a day. And Rav Kook came in to the woods where they were. He saw him with the Gemara, and he took the Gemara from him, and he says, I'm going to tell you a story. He says, Rav Kook says, when I was a young rabbi, I went on vacation for a month. The city, I guess it was Boisk, where that's, he was a city, a rav in two places, Zoymel and Boisk. They gave him a month off, like we give our rabbis a month off. And in one of the relaxation places in Lithuania, he says, I was sitting in the forest and I had a Gemara in my hand. And suddenly an old rabbi, he doesn't say his name, came to me. He's a Gadol B'Torah in Yerach Shemayim, and he took the Gemara away from me. And he says, this is gezel, this is thievery. I mean, thievery, learning Gemara. And Rav Kook says, what did I do? Who did I steal? Why is it thievery? And the rabbi said to him, the elderly rabbi, he says, I could tell by looking at you that you're a young rabbi. And you certainly receive a salary from your city to be a rav. Now, here you are in a place of relaxation for an entire month. You're also getting a salary now. Why are you getting a salary? The rabbi said to Rav Kook, you're not serving the people. You're not even in the city. So why should you get a salary for this month? And he says, the answer is that the people know that you work hard for 11 months, but you need to have a time to relax. They understand that. And therefore they pay for you to come for a month to relax. If you're sitting here learning Gemara the same way you did during the year, you're not relaxing and they're not getting their money's worth. So he's not saying don't learn, but you shouldn't be doing the same hard siddurim of Rabbi Parnas. When I was in high school, said that that's when, like when he was not in a regular Seder, he learned Chavetz Chaim, all the Torah, things like that. But you shouldn't be doing the regular learning because the community is not paying you to have vacation. To they're paying you to relax somewhat. So I sent that to him. We were in the middle of the letter. If you recall, I'll give you the page number here again for those following along. You can still buy the book if anyone wants to. It's Siman Kuf Mem Bet, page 309. Well, that's the response. I had written to Rabbi Mazu, says, what about if you forget to turn off the light in the fridge? When I say turn off the light, you can also, if you wish, I want to show you another item, if I can get on my screen here for a second. Here. You can buy this item if you want to keep a light in your refrigerator. Oops, no, wrong book, wrong thing. I'll show you that later. It's called the Shabbos Switch. It's, you see, I bought it 6 years, 5 years ago, almost 6 years ago. You put it in the refrigerator and every year of Shabbos or Thursday, it's, I've never forgotten, you just slide it. You don't have to take out the light and back and forth. It says currently unavailable. I assume you could still get it. It was sent to me from Passaic, so they probably still have it at the Sfarim store there. The question was, though, what do you do if you forget to turn it off? And I mentioned that Rabbi Mazuz said you have a katan below the age of chinuch, a minor. And I said maybe 6 years old. Actually, I don't think that's correct. I think six is already a chinuch. I think chinuch maybe 4 years old, I think, would be. But then I quoted Rabbi Abadi, who explained, and here's our Rabbi Abadi. We showed his pictures before. Here he is from Lakewood, very original, and he had a different perspective. He thought, for reasons I explained, and I'll say again, that you could just open and close it. You know, people, they look at Rabbi Abadi sometimes and they think he has these far-out psakim, but I can tell you from studying all of his writings that it only seems far out because of the environment has moved in a certain direction. But everything he says is actually based on halacha, not always based on the accepted halacha, but it's nothing's made up. And sometimes it reminds me almost when Chaim Soloveitchik wrote at the end of one of his articles, not Rupture and Reconstruction, a different article, that until he learned Yoredeya in Smicha, he had no clue. I mean, when he learned Yoredeya, he learned things like you can serve cold cuts on a dairy plate, something which, of course, everyone knows you can't. But of course, I mentioned this already before, but the Shulchan Aruch disagrees. So that's what's interesting about Rabbi Abadi. Then you have to start asking, well, how come we moved in a different direction? And we'll see in this case immediately why. But I just want to give you another example because his kashrus views, of course, are the most interesting. And now we're coming on Pesach. If you just go to the website of his kids, you can see that they have a Pesach list. And they tell you what you can buy on Pesach without special ashkachas or anything. But everyone always points out, kalim, that you can't, it could be cooked on a non-kosher kli. And when you learn Yoredeya, actually, you learn that it's not so clear. And on the contrary, there's a principle of stam kalim enam bnei yomam, that you assume that a utensil from a non-Jew, from anyone, hasn't been used in the last 24 hours. Now, there's a dispute whether that applies to industrial or not. But I want to read you something, just to show you how he's not out of left field. And all these people that say, if a non-Jew made something in his house and in his pot, everyone would assume, well, you can't eat it. Because even if it's kosher, it's cooked by a non-Jewish pot. I want to read you just something here. This isn't a class in kashrus, but It's in Yoredeya, Simon Kufchet, Sif Katan Dal, and this is the Taz quoting the Torah Schatas of the Ramah. And I'll read it to you in Hebrew. Haminhag lahakel liknos min hagoyim dvarim hamavushalim bekaleihem. The practice is to be lenient and to buy from non-Jews things that they cook in their own pots. Something which everyone knows in quotes, you can't do. She'ein bahem mishum bishalakum. Bishalgoyim. Because it's not, there's no bishalgoyim here. Why? Ho'il v'stam kalein enam b'nei yomam. There, we assume that they haven't used, unless we know, we assume they haven't used their pots in the last 24 hours. Va'afal pisha deno sein tam lifgam asur achadchila, even though lechadchila, we assume that it's forbidden. What does that mean, lechadchila? That means you can't tell them to do it. You can't order from them. What does he say? Mikol makom, loch shashvin anakaniya lechadchila. The Ramah says, when you buy it, that's not lechachila. In other words, you're not ordering it. You're not asking the person to make it. He makes it. And then you're walking down the street and you see it. And then you buy it. That's already b'diavad. B'diavad means after the fact. Lachein noagim heter po Krakow. He says, therefore, the minhag in Krakow, that's where the Ramah was. You can go see his kever. He says, liknos hagozim shomayim shemavashlim agoyim. That the minhag here in Krakow was to buy the nuts of water nuts, whatever that is, that the non-Jews cook. Oshar Devarim. So Ramah tells you that they would buy stuff that was made, cooked. They make these nuts on the street in Manhattan or something like that. And he says it's not, you can assume it's not, the pot hasn't been used with tarfus in the last 24 hours. And the Ramah didn't make it up. So when you see all these sucking from Rav Abadi that you can rely on the ingredients and you say, Kalim, I mean, it's, he has sources. Take my word for it. He knows halacha better than almost anyone today because he's not a brisker. He spent his entire life, even in Lakewood, only on halacha lamaisa. That's how he became the posek of the Lakewood Yeshiva, precisely because he doesn't do chakiras and he's not a Rosh Yeshiva. He's halacha lemaisa. Now, so Rav Abadi said, ask your local Orthodox rabbi if you rely on it, but he said you could open and close the freezer. And I said, and he says, because it's an example of what we call psikresha lo nichale. And someone asked correctly, well, why is that lo nichale, that psikresha that you don't benefit from? You are benefiting from it, because even if you don't want the light's there. Rav Abadi thinks that if you don't want it, then it's not considered nicha. Really, I looked into this. It could be that this depends on, there's a dispute. You have something called psikresha do ichpas, like a psikresha that you don't care about. And some people distinguish between a psikresha that you don't care about, which would be the case of the light, versus do nichale, but you are benefiting from the light. But others say, no, there's no distinction. So you can look into that if you want. I don't want to spend any more time on that. I'll just tell you what Rabbi, and he relied on the Aruch, as we saw. The Aruch who holds, not just the Aruch, other sources as well, but mostly the Aruch, that it's a psik reshul nichale is mutar l'chadchil. Rabbi Mazuz replies that Rabbi Yosef, who also mentions this idea, rejects it, that we don't rely on the Aruch. And he says that even my heter, to open the refrigerator with the young person, he says people came and they attacked me for it, but then I found that Rav Yosef agrees with me. So you can ask your local rabbi, although this goes back to the issue of the importance of the Aruch. The Aruch, Nassim ben Yechiel of Rome, says that a psikrei shel nichle, you can l'chadchila rely on, and therefore generally we don't use it, but if you forget to turn your light on, Rav Abadi says you can open and close it, relying on that. And he gives some other reasons as well. He says it's kolachar yad, not the normal way of turning on the light. He gives a couple other reasons, but it still is radical. I don't know of any other posek who holds this, but it's completely based on the sources. Now the next question I asked Rabbi Mazuz, it's really the last, it's a long one, but it's the last one, is as follows. It deals with kashrus of birds. And I'm just going to give you a brief summary. Anyone interested in the topic, Rabbi Kelman's been getting all the great people this last year. Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky gave a class on Thanksgiving on turkey. Why can we eat turkey? who says it's kosher? I mean, it comes from the New World. It's not like there was a tradition. And the halacha is, according to the Shulchan Aruch, that you need a tradition because the Torah tells you what you can eat. But the problem is we're not sure really what all these birds are in the Torah. Art scroll doesn't even translate them. So the idea is that we don't eat it unless we have a tradition. And you could hear the whole class by Rabbi Zivotofsky. What I just focused on a little thing. Today we have how many? 5, 6 types of birds we eat. And yet there used to be a lot more. And it's not so long ago. Take a look at this, what I'm going to show you now. In the 19th century, the rabbi, the shochet in Livorno, his name was Yitzchak Meir Cohen. He wrote a sefer called Zivchei Cohen. I believe it's 1832, yeah. And with all the laws of Shlita. But at the beginning of the sefer, he has pictures. Where's the pictures? Really, the pictures are originally looked like this. Hold on, black and white. So you can see it better. This is how it looks. But in some editions of the book, it was colored in. So it's beautiful with the color. And here you even have some names. But take a look here. So he has... He gives 30 different birds that were eaten in Italy. 30. And he even gives you the name. And he gives you the numbers. And then he gives you the names. So, for instance, look at number 1. It's in Hebrew, the book, except for at the beginning. Number 1. So whereas this is 1, it's on the angle. In the Sefer, it's not turned on this way. It's right side up. I don't know why in the Otzer Chachma they changed it. Here you have, I don't know how to pronounce it, it's Fagiano, it's pheasant. So here's a, show you the pheasant. Number 1, that's a pheasant, or give you in color. Where's the color pheasant? Here, that's a pheasant. And then we have all these other birds that you can go through the list. If in the copy on Otzer HaChachma, fortunately, they have the English... I think it's English here, or yeah, partridge. 3 is partridge. We don't eat partridges. Let's see what a partridge looks like. So here, there's a partridge. Now, all these 30 birds were eaten in Livorno. And that's a Masora. And the whole talk of Rabbi Zivotofsky is trying to find these Masoras. Because pheasant was a problem. Moshe Feinstein was asked about pheasant. And he says, well, who says the pheasant we have is the same pheasant they had in Europe? You can't just rely on the names. So Rabbi Zivotofsky and Ari Greenspan, they brought the pheasant to Yosef Kafach. And he's testified, yes, this course is kosher. We ate it in Yemen. And they shechted it in front of him. And he wrote a letter. And then he shows a picture of Rabbi Tendler, eating it. They served it at the halachic feast. Rav Schechter holds pheasants kosher. How can you not hold it's kosher? The rabbi of my shul, Rabbi Spivak, used to teach shlita at YU, and he did a pheasant. He told me he would check the pheasant for me if I wanted it. But my wife, she doesn't have to clean the whole thing out, so forget that. But my question to Rabbi Mazuz is, well, then can we rely on these... this list here, we have the pictures, we have the name, it's the Masora. They ate it. Can we eat it? Now, Ari Zivotofsky, his point is that he says, well, you can't rely on pictures. And you have to have an actual oral tradition. So you have to find the old Shochet from Morocco or from Aden or anything like that. And Rabbi Mazuz doesn't say that. Rabbi Mazuz, well, I'll tell you, Rabbi Mazuz says that if this... these tmunot are unknown, that if you look at it, you could see this is a partridge. And of course, you have the name, and the mechaber was a Yirat Shamayim. Efshar lismoch aleihem. You can rely on it. It's like, for instance, if all of a sudden, God forbid, all of us were killed by the Nazis or something, and the only people alive were 5-year-olds, Jews, and then they all come back to Yiddishkeit later, and they want to know, can they eat a chicken? Well, there's no one to ask because they were all children when all of us were killed. You can say they couldn't eat a chicken. Of course they could eat a chicken. The chicken has the name chicken. They know chickens were eaten. It's the same chicken. You don't need to, it doesn't make sense to say you only would need an oral tradition if you can establish it by pictures, by other things. And then, so Ramazus says you can rely on those. The OU has not accepted pheasant for reasons that we can't understand, but they did accept quail. Quail was only recently brought back, but there's other birds as well. And then Rabbi Mazuz says a few years ago, they did a masiba at Bar Ilan, a feast, and they brought all these rare birds. That's Rabbi Zivotofsky, and which there's a masora and even chagavim, the locusts, the grasshoppers. And they invited me to come and I couldn't come. I asked Rabbi Zivotofsky, since he organized it. Also, they had swordfish. They had all sorts of interesting things. He said he went to Rabbi Mazuz and I asked him and he couldn't come, but this is the sort of thing he'd be interested in. So I don't know in Israel how easy it is to get pheasant if the Rabbanut certify it, but it has the Masora. And that is, again, anyone interested, take a listen to Rabbi Zivotofsky's class on that. And Rabbi Mazuz says you can rely on it. It shows you how much we've lost, though. If 150 years ago they were eating 30 birds in Italy, they're not eating them today in Italy. They're like us. Certain birds we've settled on, and that's terrible. I already quoted the Yerushalmi, that we're going to be called to account for all the pleasures that we are given that we don't take advantage of. If these are our kosher birds, and unless you're a vegetarian, you should be eating it. And so I give a lot of credit to Ari Zivotofsky for his efforts in tracking down the old shochtim. But then I go on about Livorno, and I say as follows. I say that a few years ago, I asked one of your students, a very nice man, Rav Yair Didi. He's the rabbi of Livorno, and he had never even heard of this sefer. And then Rabbi Didi told me something interesting. The great chida, Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, is buried in Livorno, was buried in Livorno. Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai, they used to say about him, Yosef, that is Yosef Karo, ad Yosef, Chaim Yosef David Azulai, lo kam ki Yosef, none has arisen like Yosef. Now they say it about Rav Ad Yosef. After the Shulchan Aruch, the Sfaradim referred to one great rabbi as Maran, and that was Chaim Yosef David Azulai, an unbelievable figure. Well, he died. He was living in Livorno. He died there, and he was buried there. Chief Rabbi Yitzhak Nissim was very attached to Rabbi the Chida, as many of the Sephardic Gedolim were. Such an unusual, interesting figure. He's a bibliographer. His usage of Tanakh is just out of sight, how he knows all this. He wrote so much. He was a mashulach at first. He's raising money for Eretz Yisrael. He ends up in Italy and stays there many, many years. He marries his bride from Pisa, and he lives in Livorno. And then he dies there. And Rav Nissim convinced the community to allow the new state of Israel to take the bones of the Chida and rebury him in the land of Israel. And if you go to Har Menuchos, you can go. They built this big kever. It was a huge funeral. It was a very big deal. Rabbi Didi said to me that the community now, when it's a community of maybe 500 Jews struggling to hold on, he says they regret very much now that they agreed to that. Why? Because now you have the Kvarim tours. You have these people that go on the tours to see all the graves. And the Chida, there's a few Sephardic sages who the Chassidim love. And one of them is the Or HaChaim, of course, because of the Baal Shem Tov, the letter from Rav Gershom Kitta, the Baal Shem Tov, but the Chida. All the Ashkenazim know the Chida. And had the Chida still been buried in Livorno, it would be a stop on the Kvarim tours. All the Hasidim would come to visit the Chida, and that would bring money into the community. They tried to open a little restaurant, but they get no tourists, so they can't. But if had the Hasidim been coming every summer before COVID, you'd have regular groups of Hasidim. They'd journey to these places. It would bring a lot of money into the community. In the Torah in Motion tours, we went there two times. And we went to Livorno. It's very nice. Then we stopped going because kosher winery opened. And although I know Rabbi Kelman much prefers going to the shuls, the winery, they feed us lunch there. And it's people like wineries. And we don't have time to do both. So we go to Pisa. And instead of going to Livorno, which is a fascinating place, Livorno, it was what we call an Irva Ein BeYisrael. It was a center of Torah Judaism into the 19th century. And it was... It was a port city, fascinating place, and a beautiful, interesting show. But no one goes there anymore. And then I say to, but they do have Gedolim who are buried here. Yosef Ergas for Ben Amozig. And I tell Rabbi Mazuz that the square in front of the shul is called Piazza Ben Amozig. And so he replies as follows to me, that when they brought the bones of the Chidah to Israel, Rabbi Levin wasn't sure if he should go, because he wasn't sure if it was a good thing to move, you know, moving someone's bones to even Eretz Israel is not so simple. But then he did like the Goro Hagra. You open up the Tanakh, and what did he come to? Shir HaMaalos LeDavid, that's referring to Chida. Samachti Be'omrim Li Beis Hashem Nelech, you know, go into the house of God. But, you know, it implied to him that he should go to the funeral, and he went. And then he says there was a question in 38, if the bones of the Vilna Gaon should be brought to Israel. Some people want to bring Rav Nachman's bones also. But they asked Rabbi Chaim Moser Grozinski, and he opposed moving the Vilna Gaon. And now, then it says, this is what Rabbi Mazuz says. Now, after the Holocaust, they do not know exactly where the Vilna Gaon is buried. And he says, so I saw in this book, L'Osel Aid for Moshe Prager. Lo Chaval, he says, isn't it unfortunate? So Rabbi Mazuz says they should have brought the grave, the bones of the Vilna Gaon. This notion of the Gra, incidentally, what Rabbi Mazuz says is absolutely correct. I call your attention to, where is it? Here, Schneer Lyman, in a post from 2012, who was buried in the Vilna Gaon's tomb? And he explains exactly what's going on, that what is marked as the Vilna Gaon's tomb, where is it? He says at the end, he examines all the evidence, and he tells you where he's buried, but not where the marker is. So Rabbi Mazuz is correct on this. And then he says to me about Rabbi Ben Amozig. And a new book just came out, published by Rabbi Zinni of Haifa. We've spoken about him. Translation from French, from the manuscript. But he says, Rabbi Ben Amozig, his books are very important. I did, I think, two or three classes on him, Torah in Motion. He says that the rabbis of Aleppo, they attacked him, alo davar, on nothing. They attacked him because Rabbi Ben Amozig was citing ancient sources to prove things. In fact, he even cites an ancient source to support, Midrashim. He cites Pliny, that the pharaohs used to like to bathe in blood as to cure like their leprosies. And he ties that into the Midrash that talks about the bathing in the blood of the Jews. So I'm not going to say he was the Nussan Slifkin of his day, that is Rabbi Amozig, but he was citing all these ancient sources to help us understand passages in the Torah. Things today, which are kosher 100%, but in Aleppo, they were always extremists in Aleppo. And then he mentions that someone's working on to reissue the Perush. And that is enough, I think we can say, and in the end, he says what Rav Abadi says, that he tries to, his heter, that the view that electricity is not a Torah prohibition, it's only rabbinic. He says Rav Avad Yosef, this is a PS, Rav Avad Yosef disagrees with that. So that's Siman Kufmem Beis. Now we're at Siman Kufmem Gibel. We have a few more letters of Rabbi Mazuz, two more letters here, and then we'll get one or two more. Now they're small. We went through the long ones. We're on page 310. And we all know who Rabbi Soloveitchik is, because we're Ashkenazim, or we're Americans, I should say. We know that he's a philosopher, he's a halachist. I'm reading Rabbi Mazuz. This is from 2012, his letter to me. I'm reading him all these years since 1989. Not once does he ever cite Rav Soloveitchik. He's citing Rav Moshe Feinstein. He's citing everyone. He's not citing Rav Soloveitchik. How could someone like him not cite Rav Soloveitchik? So I sent him Nefesh HaRav. If you want to get a sense of Rav Soloveitchik, halachic perspectives and ideas, nothing's better than Rabbi Schechter's first volume, Nefesh HaRav, which has mistakes, he acknowledges. We're going to see a mistake that he acknowledges to me. Where he says he acknowledges mistakes. He did it within a year. He had to finish it within a year. And the mistakes are always when it says Shamati. That's been my experience. That is, he has things, when it's personal, then you can rely on it. But sometimes there's things in the legends in YU. So he'll cite it, Shamati, I heard. So who do you hear from? Doesn't mean it's reliable. And I can give you some examples perhaps where it's not reliable. But I sent to Rabbi Mazuzra of Soloveitch Nefesarov, and he says as follows to me. He writes back to me, I don't know the writings of Hagon Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. All I know is Kol Dodi Dofek, Isha Amunah V'Obedei, there's Kol Dodi Dofek, which is his classic Zionist essay, Isha Amunah V'Obedei, which is the Holy Man of Faith, and his other writings. In other words, here you have Rabbi Mazuz. Granted, he comes from Tunis, but he thought that Rabbi Soloveitchik was like a great Orthodox philosopher, like Levinas maybe, or more than Levinas, of course, because he's a Talmud Chacham, but that he's a philosopher, that he wasn't a great Rosh Hashiva, that he wasn't a posseg, and he was a posseg, although he didn't write Shels and Shuvos generally. He was a posseg for Boston. He was the head of the Lach Commission for the RCA. He was Gadol Shebegdolim, and Rabbi Mazuz didn't even know that. It's almost like Rabbi Mazuz is like these scholars of Jewish philosophy. Sometimes they portray Rabbi Soloveitchik as fundamentally a philosopher who happened to teach Talmud. You know, that was how he made his living. He taught Talmud, but really, essentially, he was more of a philosopher. It's not true at all. Rabbi Soloveitchik was, his major focus was on the study of Gemara and Halacha, and all these other things were extra and enable you to understand Talmud better. But Rabbi Soloveitchik was primarily focused on his Talmud study, and I guess in the summer, on his breaks, then he would focus and write about these other things. This is different than Rav Kook. Rav Kook's major focus, and even if you tell me that 80% of his time was spent on halacha as a rav, his major focus, and he says it explicitly, was not on the halachic matters. Rav Kook says that I don't have much originality when it comes to halacha. My originality is in agadah, in philosophy. So this is, I don't know if this is the Rabbi Mazuz observing the yeshiva world's portrayal of the Rav as this philosopher to try to remove from him the fact that he's the greatest Rosh Hashiva of his time. As Rabbi Tenwer says, greatest Rosh Hashiva. So people said, what do you mean? What about your father-in-law? But Rabbi Tenwer's point was that his father-in-law's greatness is mostly seen as a posek, and Rav Soloveitchik as a Rosh Hashiva. And then he says, in matters of halacha, I never saw or heard of him until now. And it appears that this is a form of modern orthodoxy, orthodoxia modernita. Only someone who's living in a completely different world than us would not know that the Rav is so great in those areas. And then we get a different question. And I think, I know some of you, David Eisen will like this, Susanna will like it, and some others of you will like it. Getting back to a grammatical point. And we know the Ten Commandments. We spoke about the Ten Commandments. How do you say Ten Commandments in Hebrew? Aseret HaDibros. So already we see it's not Eser, it's masculine. So the question is, what's this word, HaDibrot? I'm going to pull up something here. I'm going to have to show you. If we say HaDibrot, then why is it, is that feminine? Is that, I'll get you the one I want to show you in a minute. Then if it's feminine, why is it Saris? What I had mailed, and this will be the last, we started 2 minutes later, so we can go on. I asked for my mazuz as follows. Is it really correct that we refer to it as the Aseret HaDibrot? Maybe it should be, hold on, let's see where my page is here. Maybe it should be like, who says it's a Aseret HaDibrot? And what would be the, if it's Davar, then would that be Dibrot? I brought a proof. It's not my proof. What I'm going to show you now, I saw in, believe it or not, in the Journal of Biblical Literature years ago. It's not exactly your regular nighttime reading, but Journal of Biblical Literature, an article by Robert Gordas. Robert Gordas, who's a great scholar of Tanakh and taught for many years at the seminary. Before that was an acting conservative rabbi. He wrote the standard work on Kri Yuchtiv. So he wrote an article in Journal of Biblical Literature. His grandson is he's a real public intellectual, Daniel Gordas. if you know Daniel Gordis, who he's involved with Tikva also, and he's written a book on Begin. He wrote a couple of years ago, A Requiem for Conservative Judaism. He comes from royalty, you know, the Gordis family, and his father's a rabbi, conservative rabbi. And basically, he's explaining why he's transferred his allegiance to Orthodox, even though maybe theologically he's not Orthodox, but there's no future in the conservative movement. And Robert Gordis himself, at the end of his life, I think it was his last essay, said that we failed because we never made demands. We assumed that if you want to get the people, you have to lower the standards. And yet look at Chabad. Chabad never tells people that they can drive on Shabbos. The fact that people drive to their shul on Shabbos, fine, they drive, but Chabad never legitimizes it. Chabad keeps their standards and always hoping that people move up higher and higher. Conservative Judaism thought that they would attract people by lowering the standards, and yet people are not attracted to that. People are sophisticated enough to understand their standards, and maybe they don't measure up to it, but they're not, you don't need to lower standards. So Gordis acknowledged that. Well, Gordis pointed out the following. I want you to look here in the Mechilta. It says as follows. You see where my marker is. Do you see the marker? Yes. It says, Ma nishtana hadavar hazeh mikol? So what is, how does this, we know ma nishtana, right? How does this matter, davar, differ, mikol? How is that word supposed to be pronounced? It's not pronounced debrot. It has to be pronounced devarot. Ma nishtana hadavar, ma nishtana hadavar hazeh mikol hadavarot shebatorah. And then it goes on, shekulan hayumi pimosha. What we see from here is that in Gordis says, in Lashon Chazal, how is it called in the Torah? It says Aseret HaDvarim, the 10 words or the 10 statements. So what Gordis says is that if you look in Chazal, the 10 Dvarim become the 10 Dvarot. And we have lots of examples where a masculine word will have a feminine ending. So I wrote to Rabbi Mazuz, what do you make of this? And we'll end with this. This will be our last point. What do you make of this? That really we're all making a mistake. It shouldn't be Aseret HaDibrot. It should be Aseret HaDvarot. And the proof is the Mechilta, which it's clear that the plural of Davar, they're giving Davar with a Vav Tav ending. So should we apply the same thing to Aseret HaDibrot? Rabbi Mazuz replies to me, we have one more thing after this. He doesn't think so. He doesn't think so, and he thinks that the root of Dibrot is as follows. This is the sort of stuff I even looked in BDB, and I couldn't find this. He thinks the root of Dibrot is found in, where is it, in the book of Yirmiyahu, this word, chapter 5, very unusual word, 5:13. Look at this pasuk. V'hanevi'im yiyu ruach, the prophet shall become wind, v'hadiber ein bahem, and the word is not in them. This is, I think it's pretty much unique, where instead of hadavar, you have, or dibur, you have the word diber used as a noun. And Rabbi Mazuz says, this, the plural of dibrot is diber. It's not dibra or anything like that. It can't be feminine because it would then be, it wouldn't be aseret. So the plural of aseret hadibrot is this unusual word diber. And he says, we have a number of examples like this. Avot, it's a feminine ending. Luchot. And he gives other examples. Shulchanot. And he says, for whatever reason, the word diber, a word, the plural is a feminine, dibrot. And that is the tradition, and it's based on the authentic word diber, unlike what Gordis says, that really it's all a mistake, devarot. I don't know if there's any other solution. It either has to be devarot, like Gordis says, or dibrot, but if it's dibrot, which we assume it is, that's the tradition, the root has to be diber. Now go in your shul next time you're there, if you're going to shul this Shabbos, or when you get your vaccine, and ask your local Hebraist, what's the singular of Dibrot? We all know the Aseret Dibrot. What's the singular? And they'll say Davar, probably, but then if it's Davar, well, how is Dibrot the plural of Davar? That's the first question I asked him. And the final one we'll end with is, you can't see my question. I'll read you his answer and then I'll explain the question. He says, the word Torah is certainly a feminine word. It can't be masculine. If we say Katuv b'Torah, what it means is the Torah, in the Torah, Katuv Kach, it's written this. And we will never say the Torah Kotev. So what's going on here? Why? Let me show you something. And this shows that I'm not on top of things the way I should be. But I'm going to show you two psukim here. Where are we here? Yes. So if you look in... where's my Chumash with Rashi? Yes. If you look in the Chumash on in Ha'azinu, Nitzavim, chapter 29, verse 20, and this will take us back to Rabbi Weider. What does the Torah say? It says, God will, Lord will single you out from all the tribes for misfortune, kechol alot tabrit, in accordance with the sanctions of the covenant. Now look at this, hakatuva b'sefer ha-Torah hazeh, that are written in the Sefer HaTorah Hazeh. Maybe I recall this pasuk, where it clearly says HaTorah Hazeh. So I thought that maybe sometimes Torah could be feminine, just because I have a hey ending. Lila also has a hey ending.
Excuse me? I think that Hazeh refers to HaSefer.
Well, that you know more than I did, but I wasn't looking at it, because if I'd look, you'd see Rashi. Rashi actually deals with my question. So I will show you Rashi in a second, but I'll show you, but here's the problem. So then you turn to another pasuk. This is what Rashi points out. Now, if you look, but thank you for that, because you're anticipating Rashi. If you look here in Perek Chafres, what does it say here? Then it says, the Lord will bring upon you all the other diseases, asher lo katuv, which are not written, b'sefer HaTorah Hazot. So here it says Sefer HaTorah Hazot, feminine. And before it said Sefer, it says Sefer HaTorah Hazeh. So which is it? Well, had I don't even remember when I wrote the letter. I didn't check. I just had it in my mind for some reason that sometimes Torah is masculine. It's not. It's never masculine. And Rashi raises the question in Hazinu. And Rashi points out, and he cites both, in Nitzavim, he cites both verses. Look at this verse. Look at the Diktuk. In the Tamim, it says, B'sefer. So that, as we saw from Rabbi Weider, that ends, that closes, I forget the technical English term they use then for, someone's going to remind me of when it closes the Tamim. Close. What? What is it?
It's disjunctive.
Disjunctive. There you go. Disjunctive. Okay. Disjunctive and conjunctive. Okay. So it ends it. B'sefer nitzav HaTorah Hazot. Now, if you look in the other pasuk, here it is. Exactly what I think it was Susanna who was saying it. It says, Kecho alot habrit, haktuva b'sefer HaTorah. Disjunctive ends. So sefer HaTorah goes together. Hazeh. So it's b'sefer HaTorah. Hazeh. So, this is not mentioned in the book, but this will explain what's in the background here, why there even would be a question. When I would send him on letters, I'd send him on these postcards. I didn't save them, unfortunately. The longer letters I sent on my computer, I have them. So if you're ever wondering why there would be a question, know that Rashi himself raises it, because Rashi understood that people would be confused like me. Of course, my problem is I should have looked it up and found where the verses are and then looked in Rashi. You don't have any excuses if you ask a question and the Rebbe says to you, well, you know, Rashi asked that. If he says the Ramban asks it, or Ibn Ezra, but if he says Rashi asks it, it's a little embarrassing. Well, so I'm telling you, it's a little embarrassing, but Rashi was attentive to this, that people would look at it and wonder why in one place it's masculine, in another place it's feminine. And Rashi tells us, look at the trup. The trup tells you. And that's why Trump is important. Okay, we have gone far enough. We went a little longer than usual. We started a little longer. Let me take some of the questions. We finished off the Siman. So we'll start next week. The last of the short letters in this section from Rabbi Mazuz. We'll hear from Rabbi Rasabi next week. And also Rabbi Yitzhak Hershkovitz. I don't know if any of you know who that is. I'll explain. A Koisenberger chassid. And Rabbi Yosef Lieberman, and back to Rav Shmuel Ashkenazi, and then the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which I don't think we'll get to next week. So let's get to some of the questions quickly. I know it's late. Someone texted me privately that Cole Aaronson graduated from Yale, had a column in the Yale Daily, the Oxford. He clearly is very, very intelligent, and I know we'll hear more and more about him in the future. And Baruch says, instead of saying alachas comma a comma, say a fortiori. Then it'll sound perfectly normal. I learned that word a fortiori when I was in high school using the Sansino Talmud. And kavachomer, they would translate it as a fortiori. Avi texts that the Rav used to speak of Abraham, Moses, and Jacob. If you look at Rav Moshe Feinstein's stationery, it says Moses. See, Rav Moshe wasn't so frum. If you look today, no one would dream of doing that. In fact, Rav Moshe Sternbach doesn't even say Moshe. It's M-O-I, Moshe. But Rav Moshe Feinstein lived before Frumkeit because he would sign as Moses. If it's on the English side, it's English, so he wrote Moses. On the Hebrew, he wrote Moshe. But and Rabbi Soloveitchik was Joseph B. Soloveitchik, and that's the way they did it. Baruch says, Dalfin is competing with Jacob Neusner. Yes, and this year alone, he's put out 3 or 4 books. In 2021. We just started 2021. Israel Shiner says, Dalfin, contact someone in Satmar to see if they can arrange a book ban so that it would sell better. And Barry says the story about Rav Gurel and Rav Huttner, he heard. It's a famous story because Rav Gurel came back to YU and told everyone about the story. Mel says a slightly different story. David says Yehuda and Tamar seem to have engaged in a form of Yibum. That's what he's referring to in the parish of Rav Avraham ben Arambam. Mel says, according to Rav Kefir Grill, turned around to leave the room and was rebuked by Rav Huttner. Could be. You know, these stories, there's a kernel of truth, but they get changed and everything. I just told you the version I heard. It could be that. And Israel says that Rav Belsky was strongly opposed to the kosher switch. They brought it to Rav Schechter. And Rav Schechter said that the Rav would never approve. And then if you listen, Rav Arye Leibowitz gave a shiur on it in which he explained the problems. But Rav Yehuda Bracha, we're not talking first, the greatest of the great in Eretz Yisrael, but he's a very fine posek and Talmud Chacham or Pinsach Zabichi. These are all students of Avad Yosef, and they came out halacha l'maisa that it's permissible because it's not grumma, and it can't take off. No one's going to buy it. We have the Shabob, so that's okay, I guess. And Jay Yellen tells us he's used it for many years, the Shabob. And my wife has it, two of them, double one, and it's the regular bulb. She doesn't take it out. I, however, when I go on, I have one when I go to Florida, for instance, in 2 weeks, I bring it with me. I just have to not forget to leave it in the hotel room. I take it everywhere I go. It doesn't burn out. It's LED. They say it has 10,000 hours. So it's going to be a long, long time. And if it burns out, yeah, you buy a new one. It's not cheap. It's like $25. You can get it on Amazon. Or you can get it in Lakewood. And you can get it in all the Sfarim stores. The kosher lamp. That's the big and bulkier. And you don't get good light in the kosher lamp. I think the kosher lamp's just a regular bulb. This is LED. It's very nice. So if you don't know what it is and you want to have a nightlight or a guest room light or something, it's very good. David says the work is not an autobiography, but a biographical work on Rav Goren by Avi Rath. David, by the way, David, you're going to be made famous again by me in my next post. Not the post that's coming out now, the next one, because I'm going to return to the Rav Zevin issue that you did all that work for me. So we'll get back to that. But I have to differ with you here. I said it's an autobiography. You said it's a biographical work. It's actually in the middle. Rabbi Goren gave some 20 hours of talks on a tape recorder recording his life. Avi Rath took those tapes and turned it into a work. So, it's not a biography. He's writing first person. Avi Rath took the material. It's Arichat Avi Rath, and it says on the cover, Ba'oz Tatzunot Autobiographia. So it's Rabbi Goren, and it's first person telling his life story, which is then written down. iPad says, can't you just tape down the switch that is triggered when the fridge door is open? But let's say you want the light during the week. So this new thing is you just go back and forth, and it's not a problem. Growing up, we never had a light. So I never had a light. We unscrewed it. But my wife likes a light. So I guess I could put a reminder on my my Google calendar to remind me. But I always remember every Thursday when I'm cleaning out. And that way you go back and forth if you want. Mel says that modern refrigerators has a pre-programmed Shabbos mode that knows when Shabbos and Yom Tov starts and automatically disables the light. Well, you know, I've had my refrigerator 20 years and it's falling apart and the automatic water fountain doesn't work anymore. So we got to get it. When I have some money, I'm going to buy a new refrigerator. And I guess I should find one of those. That'll be helpful. I didn't know about that, Mel. Thank you very much. And thank you, Rabbi Kelman. He has the link there for Rabbi Zivotofsky's very interesting shiur. And yes, and thank you, Yael Yaakov, for that as well. Very nice. And David has posted a picture of Rabbi Zivotofsky through Atias with a partridge. I think that's from Atias, was from Algeria, I believe. And Mel says he was with us in Livorno. We had one lunch in a shul. Yes, we did. And there was it's an active community with Minyonim and Shiurim. There is. There's about after Rome, it's the only active community because Florence is nothing really, just and Venice is nothing. The only place with Balabatim is in Livorno. And these are people who've been there, who came back after the war. And indeed, someone privately texts me that the critics of Nefesh HaRav note that the greatness of Soloveitchik took Vortluch and transformed them to broad philosophical insights, where Rav Schechter took went the other direction, Vortluch. Look, you're not going to get Larry Kaplan's understanding of the Rav and Halachic Man. You're not going to get any of that from Nefesh HaRav. You're not going to get the philosophy of the Rav if you're looking how he deals with Hermann Cohen and all the important stuff. What you do get from Nefesh HaRav is the Rav and how he relates to different halachic matters, and you get a sense of his table talk. And table talk is important, and you get a sense of his halachic shitot in many areas. Yes, Baruch HaSarat HaDvarim, correct. But and so Gordas's point was that became HaDvarot in Lashon Chazal. So Susanna says she took a class with Professor Moshe Greenberg, and he always said the singular as Diber. So then, had I known that, I wouldn't have needed to write to Rabbi Mazuz. And Yelen Yaakov tells us that Danny Gordas was a member of his shul. He comes from a house, incidentally, which is very liberal. His father was, as I recall, on the Rabbinic Board of Americans for Peace Now. My sense is, I've only spoken to him once or twice, is that he's like many of these other people who went to Israel and were mugged by reality and became conservative while we're there. Menachem Kellner's he's another example of this. They went there, peaceniks and leftists, but at the end of the day, the Palestinians showed, and it took a long time for the left to realize this. It's why there's no Labor Party anymore. The Labor Party ran Israel, and they might not even next election even get in. It's that there's no one to make peace with, and Danny Gordas is very insightful and recommended. Also, Mel says, there's a recent Tikva podcast with Gil and Tevi Troy, who grew up in conservative Judaism, about the failure. I didn't listen to it, but I saw the description about it. David says he doesn't think Gordas can be correct in light of the Yerushalmi that spells the word Adibrot with a yud. That would be true. I think Gordas might say that that could be. We don't have actual manuscripts from the days of Chazal, so this is maybe the way they put in Yud later on, 12th century, 13th, 14th, whatever. Maybe the printer. We'd have to look at the manuscripts of the Yerushalmi. Do they all have the Yud? And then you could say, who says that that's right? That could be later copyists who add it. That was Gordas's chiddush. I don't know if anyone else agreed with him. I just wanted to hear what Rabbi Mazuz said about that chiddush, because it struck me as interesting. And iPad points out the choice is for people like Gordas or Troy, do you want a community of ritual commitment versus a community of intellectual freedom? The famous thing Halivni said, the people I pray with, I can't talk to, and the ones I talk to, I can't pray with. I don't see it that way. I think it's all about the ritual, because the other communities are not serious also intellectually. It's just a lifestyle of people. If you want to be a real conservative Jew, which means like you do have in places, you have in the Upper West Side, but it means that you're Shomer Shabbos and Kashrus, and you end up having to go to an Orthodox synagogue, because if your kids, if you're Shomer Shabbos, you're going to say in Salman Shechter, literally none of your kids' friends will be Shomer Shabbos. Their bar mitzvahs will all be on Shabbos. They'll have parties or they'll be serving treif, and they won't think anything of it. So if you are a serious conservative Jew who believes in these things, you end up having to compromise on mechitzah and things like that, because there are no conservative synagogues that have strong, committed lay people. Other than like in the Upper West Side, maybe there's a couple others. And that's, so I don't think it's versus a commune of intellectual freedom. I think it's simply, you want to be with Shomer Shabbos people. David says the Mechilta writes the word Dibrit with the Yud. Everything you said, David, could be correct. Unfortunately, I can't point this out to Robert Gordis. But the example he gave from the Mechilta I showed you, where it says, I showed you that Mechilta. That's 12.1. That's the one I showed you this is 11. Sorry, Parsha 11. So I don't know. It's hard to know without looking at manuscripts. Daniel Stolman says that I thought the birds we eat are related to commercial reasons, not kosher. No, that's not. Look, if no one liked the taste, we wouldn't. But the OU will not give hashkacha to all the ones over in the picture, and they won't give it to pheasant, not because people won't eat it, but because they say they're not kosher. We can't determine their kosher. If they're kosher, someone will give hashkacha to it. Birds are easy, generally, all these birds. They would eat them in Italy. We're not dealing with like a giraffe or something like that where it's hard to catch. I don't know what bavorn means, Naftali. If you know, you tell me. Oh, you think bavorn is fergern? What is fergern? Type that in. Yes, and Rav Gorin's autobiography is available in English. Okay, thank you all. Highland Park has a strong conservative synagogue where priority is Shomer Shabbat. We have in Jersey also near me in West Caldwell, where we have conservative viewer Caldwell, who are Shomer Shabbos. But most conservative shuls you go to, I've been to some, you could have 1,000 families. And other than the rabbi and the cantor, literally no one is Shomer Shabbos. And truth be told, I don't want to say this out loud, so loud, but even the rabbi and the cantor are not Shomer Shabbos because they drive to shul. I don't know if you know this, many conservative rabbis drive to shul, and cantors drive to shul also. So that's the situation at the conservative movement. David says no one eats giraffe because it doesn't taste good. I would think it's hard to find it. Where are you going to get giraffe? Are you going to get it from Africa and bring it? And you think the expense, you'd have to buy a baby giraffe and grow it to give the benefit of the doubt. Does Fergern. Okay. Very good, everyone. Thank you. I enjoyed it. Thank you for your comments and questions again. Look forward to seeing you all next week. And Rabbi Kelman, take it away.
I believe Ari Zivotofsky, also have to go look on our site, has a talk on giraffe that he gave live in Toronto on a Saturday night, probably 10 years ago.
Yes, because people are under the misconception that you don't know where to shecht it.
You can't get them. It's illegal. We're going to get a giraffe. First of all, have you ever seen a giraffe? If you come when we used to do our tours to Africa with Rabbi Slifkin, a giraffe with one kick can kill a lion. The strength of a giraffe is unbelievable, and they are so tall and so you can't get a giraffe, and it's illegal. But it's kosher anywhere. You can slaughter it anywhere on the neck, and it's got a big neck, and it's fine. But Ari Zivotofsky has a whole thing. I'll try to. It should be on our website once we're talking about his talks. Okay,